So that from 1992 is X-Sight, The Light, They're Here Dance Mix. One of the tunes I can remember enjoying in the 1990s. But so welcome back to the BCFM online only politics show with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Well, US fighters are buzzing, that is, aircraft buzzing in an Iranian airliner over Syria. What are these illegal US jets doing there? And they cause injuries on board the airliner because it had to take evasive action. Also, China must retaliate, to quote somebody, we'll see who in a minute, after the US closes the Houston consulate. And apparently there was somebody hiding in the consulate who thought that they were going to be arrested, a Chinese person. So the US has decided they're going to close the consulate instead. So I imagine they're all using that as an excuse to arrest this person and put them on trial, whoever they are. And Pompeo says the US will no longer tolerate China. What is he talking about? How can he say we're no longer going to tolerate China? Also today, Goldman Sachs has paid $4 billion as a fine in compensation over the 1MDB scandal in Singapore, as their state wrestles back control from the international Bilderberg banksters. Also, was lingerie chain Victoria's Secret's owner Les Wexner the Epstein and Maxwell money man? That's what one of Maxwell and Epstein's cool girls, Maria Farmer, believes in conversation with Chile-based US journalist Whitney Webb. And finally, what was really poisoned in Salisbury, the Skripals or US-Russia relations? Those bungling Russians in Salisbury and the Skripal affair were the reason Theresa May's government passed the UK version of the 2012 US Magnitsky Act that happened in May 2018, and it's just been used to put 49 Russians on the list. This allows UK authorities to name any person at any time with no appeal and no question as human rights abusers or money launderers. Wherever they are in the world, their UK assets are then frozen and their visas rescinded. So first tonight, why the Salisbury story can't possibly be true. The pandemic also to cover the bailout. His website is Alex Craner, is the guy we'll be talking to, is Third Alliance, T-H-I-R-D, thirdalliance.ch. His book, The Grand Deception, The Truth About Bill Browder, The Magnitsky Act and Anti-Russia Sanctions. So I think we should start, Martin, with this horrendous attack, really, on a Iranian airliner by US fighters. What, first of all, what are these US fighters doing flying around over Syria? Surely the Russians or the Syrians should just shoot them down.
Well, they could, but that would then escalate the situation. So they basically ignored them.
Are they based in Syria? Where are they
they're
flying?
They're probably in Jordan. From? They're probably based in Jordan.
Flying in from a foreign country? Surely when they cross the border, they should just be shot down, shouldn't they?
Well, if the Syrians did shoot them down, they would be within their rights. But they've chosen
not to. So why don't they?
Because they're trying to avoid a war, unlike the Americans, who are trying to create a war. The purpose of this...
We would not be allowing Russian jets, for example, to fly around over Britain, would we?
No, we wouldn't.
And if they decided they were going to do that, would we shoot them down? I think we would.
We probably would, yeah.
So what's the difference between us and the Syrians?
The Syrians have had a 9-year onslaught directed by Western intelligence services, the Saudi Mukhabarat, and various jihadi groups, which in fact we fund and direct. And they've been fighting, they've taken tens of thousands of casualties in the Syrian army. But do you know what? They've won, because it's their country and we're not going to tell
them
what to do.
Well, the Americans, in the form of CENTCOM, and I think they are one of these, aren't they based in Stuttgart in Germany, I think they might be?
Yeah.
These are the American commands of the whole world. Now, you know, you hear stories of people wanting to take over the world. Well, the Pentagon did that when it created this unified command structure. And CENTCOM is the one for the Middle Eastern region. They confirmed the incident, saying that they intercepted the airliner in accordance with international standards to ensure the safety of U.S. ground troops at the Al Tanf base inside Syria. They confirmed that it was identified as a Maha Air flight, but did not specify any specific contact. The US has blacklisted Maha Air, accusing them of smuggling arms. So effectively, that's what these US jets were doing, Martin. But apparently, this was just an airliner. There may have been arms on there, we don't know. But the abrupt change of course that the airliner had to do when these fighters flew right next to it, that several people were injured as the abrupt change in course. The plane then landed at Beirut and after a stop-off returned back to Tehran without incident.
Well, the Al-Tanf base is illegal. There's no basis for it in international law.
But the Americans are there sending these jets up to protect it, apparently.
Yeah, but they shouldn't be there at all. There's actually a refugee camp not far away. The refugees actually want to leave the camp and go to Syrian government control, but the Americans won't let them, and they won't let anybody else in there to find out what's going on. Don't forget, there have been all sorts of attacks on infrastructure inside Iran. We were talking about Russian cyber attacks on British infrastructure. Well, the Israelis and the Americans have been carrying out cyber attacks on Iranian infrastructure in the last week. And the war faction in Israel wants to see a war with Iran before the November election because they're a bit worried that Biden won't be as biddable as Trump. And of course, if there is a war with Iran, Boris Johnson will jump in with both feet. And of course, it's nothing that we're talking about. But if it happens, there will be all sorts of consequences. And probably worrying about COVID and Brexit will be the least of our worries. But that's the dangerous world we live in and the kind of reckless people who are in charge of it. And I would regard the British government as a bit like a teenage girl who's got into a stolen car with their boyfriend and wants to get out now, but he ain't stopping. And the police are the whole thing is turning into a nightmare. And that's probably what will happen if the war faction in Israel gets its way. And of course, they get lots of encouragement from the war faction in the US and others in the deep state here.
Okay, another story. China has got to retaliate after the US closes its consulate in Houston. I understand there's somebody who has broken, or at least the Americans allege, has broken the terms of her visa, had her house raided when she was in and around Houston somewhere, and then she decided rather than just kind of carry on as normal, she would seek some sort of shelter in the Chinese consulate there. The Americans have now decided they're going to close the consulate.
Yeah, I believe the Chinese have closed a similar consulate inside China. Because, of course, you can do that. I mean, these are the preludes to war.
It's the Wuhan one, I think, that they've decided they want to close.
Yeah, that's right. Well, the Wuhan, Wuhan consulate, all of those people were repatriated to the US at the beginning of the COVID crisis. They now want to go back, and the Chinese have been saying you can come back, but we're going to test you all before you can come in, because that's what non-Kutistan countries are doing. They've got rid of the virus and they don't want it coming back. But in any case, this is more to do with diplomatic saber-rattling. And as you mentioned there, Pompeo is saying the US is no longer going to tolerate China, which seems an extraordinary thing to say, because I don't see how they're going to get rid of China other than a nuclear attack, which is suicidal for the United States.
Even then, it won't get rid of it. There'll still be some Chinese left.
Well, that's what Mao Zedong famously said back in the 1960s. If there's a nuclear war, millions will die, but communism will be successful and capitalism will be defeated. And that's one of his famous quotes.
What does he really mean, though, when he says we will no longer tolerate China? I mean, this just seems to say that they're not going to be part of the international architecture to whatever extent the Americans can enforce that.
Yeah, that's basically what it is.
We don't recognise China as a country.
Yeah, no, what they want to do is overthrow the Chinese communist regime. Now, and since 1972, when Nixon went to talk to Mao Zedong and Zhou Enlai, as it then was.
I think it was with Henry Kissinger, wasn't it?
Basically, there's been a gradual a practical relationship developed between the Chinese government and the West. And, of course, what really worries the deep state in the US is that the Chinese are just getting too good at capitalism. And, very successful companies like Huawei with a lower cost base and a better product than they've got, they can't tolerate. And that's one of the reasons why I suspect there may have been a biowarfare attack. Because if you don't get the Chinese now, in 5 or 10 years' time, you're not going to be able to catch them. And it's quite clear that Pompeo and the faction he represents in the CIA and others are determined to have a war with China, or at least an ongoing confrontation with China, because any war is likely to be one-sided. If there's a fight in the South China Sea, US aircraft carriers are all going to be sunk. So that's 5,000 chaps on each aircraft carrier. It won't take long until they've got a big casualty list. And of course, the Chinese have got a very, very big army. And if they're defending what they regard as their own territory, they're not going to pull any punches, are they?
Okay, so he's also been in the UK this week, Pompeo, hoping for some big splash with this Intelligence and Security Committee on China. But it looks to me as if he is a bit of a damp squib, and he's turned up and he was hoping for this massive attack on Russia from the British Intelligence and Security Committee, and he didn't really get that, did he?
Yeah, I don't think he came because of that committee. He came because he's basically whipping Boris into line for the coming war on China, as John Pilger's film warned everybody about some years ago. They are basically going to have a confrontation with China. Very dangerous stuff. The Chinese are well able to defend themselves. And of course, one of the other things that the Chinese are doing, they're talking to the Syrian army. There are Chinese army liaison officers working with the Syrian army, not least because there's plenty of Uyghurs inside the Idlib pocket who have been, pushed in there by the Turkish MIT secret services. So, we are on the brink of major confrontations unless common sense prevails.
This is when we are having confrontations. These are confrontations. Yeah. The basic relations between China and the US breaking down, the relations between Britain and Russia breaking down,
yeah,
although it doesn't seem as if they've broken down quite as much as they might have done this week. There seems to be an attempt, and in fact, even with the vaccine, the virus, and all this sort of stuff, there is an enormous divisions being created in society by all this. It does seem as if there's this whole what we call the expression hardening the sides going on, where people are increasingly, like you and I maybe, over the coronavirus, Martin, having to choose their side.
Yeah, I think that,
so you don't have a spread of opinion. Yeah, well, you've got one side or the other.
Well, yes, I mean, it's polarisation, isn't it? I think what's beginning to be, I mean, the Chinese and the Russians basically just want to do business with the West. That's all they want. Just recognise that we exist. Let's cooperate together.
The United States is saying no. States is now saying no because you've outcompeted us. So we've had enough of you guys.
Yes, and that of course, as we had that GRU guy, GRU guy, on the show some weeks ago. That's the Russian secret military intelligence saying, well, we think this COVID attack is a bioweapon. It's designed to undermine China, and we're all going to war. Now, he wasn't speaking in an official capacity, but it was from a video. He was wearing a uniform. I'm pretty certain that the Russian and Chinese intelligence services are pretty good, have pretty much worked out what's going on, and they've worked out there's no point talking to the West. They ain't interested.
But they are talking to us, aren't they?
Yeah, they're pretending to carry on talking while they get ready to fight. That's where we're at.
Okay, well, one part of all of this, and we've been talking a lot about potential military warfare and lots about the economic warfare today, and of course cyber warfare, with the alleged Russian attempts to hack or alter the results of the Brexit vote and other elections here in Britain. Well, yes, me too. I think the whole thing is complete hot air, Martin. But, I mean, on the side of psychological warfare, Richie Allen this week again was talking to Neil Oliver, the well-known TV presenter, historian, about censorship generally. And I thought this was an absolutely fascinating piece here. What Richie is saying, and this would fit in with what you're saying, Martin, about 2020 being potentially, well, the Great Reset, but what is going to cause the Great Reset, Prince Charles's great dream, is potentially a really, catastrophic economic and possibly even a fighting war later on this year. And what Richie has been doing is chatting, he says, to one of his friends who works at Google, is saying that that YouTube and Google, who of course are absolutely dominant in the internet, are now thinking about cutting off loads of free speech later on this year. But anyway, he's chatting here with Neil Oliver, the historian, too. So let's have a listen to Richie Allen this week talking about censorship.
I was listening to talk radio earlier on today, and very interesting little bit of commentary from Neil Oliver. Now, Neil Oliver is an archaeologist and a broadcaster, and he's a very interesting guy, is Neil Oliver. He was on Mike Graham's programme, and Oliver was lamenting how utterly impotent comedy is in 2020, and he was also musing about self-censorship. And the chap, Neil Oliver, is very eloquent. This is stark stuff. Have a listen to what he says.
And people are being terribly careful not to say the wrong word, just to trot out dogma, just to say the things that they think will get them the pass to the, you know, to the rest of their lives and to be able to go about their business unmolested. Mm. And there's definitely been a lack of humour. You know, what passes for comedy on mainstream television at the moment, I would say, is risible in the very worst sense of the word. It's pompous, censorious sermons, sneering at various sections of the society. I don't feel inclined to laugh about it. I've found that I've had to go mining for contraband, you know, on YouTube and other platforms, looking for the humour of the past. You mentioned Billy Connolly.
Yeah.
You know, me partly probably because of my upbringing and whatever. I revere Connolly as one of the funniest human beings ever to draw breath.
Yeah.
But I've gone back looking for, you know, Bill Hicks, Robin Williams, Chris Rock,
yeah.
Because I'm in desperate need of the irreverence. I'm in desperate need of it. It's like taking illicit drugs or something.
Yes.
You know, going back and hearing someone, even just 10 years ago, having the audacity, you know, to say the unsayable. Because that's where we are now.
Yeah.
The unsayable is definitely there. Pretty soon you'll be caught out for thinking the unthinkable.
Yes.
Yeah, it's occurring to a lot of people like him. Maybe it wouldn't have occurred to him before COVID. It is dawning on people like him what is happening to their world, to their friends and family, and they don't like it, and they're speaking out about it. Is it too late? I don't know. Let me tell you this very briefly. I put a post on Facebook earlier on today. I've known a couple of guys who've worked for Google. In fact, I know three guys. Two who worked for Google and one guy who left Google and who came on this program to talk with me a year and a half ago about Google's censorship against alternative right platforms. And my two mates who work at Google, both of them still there, they've dropped me one or two bits of information over the years. Nothing groundbreaking, really. Just little bits of information about things that are happening there. And I was in touch with one of them this morning. And he said to me, look, you need to have a heads up on what's been happening around the COVID virus and the COVID vaccine. And he said to me, before a COVID vaccine is ready, it's already been decided by Google, YouTube. Google owns YouTube. That's the dreadful thing in and of itself. I talked about that many, many times on the program. They have decided that they're going to take down thousands, possibly tens of thousands of channels around about the time that the vaccine is ready to go. And allegedly, they're going to do this in tandem with Facebook and Twitter, who will do the same thing. Basically, delete hundreds of thousands of groups, maybe, where people are talking about vaccine safety. Now, you can take this with a pinch of salt if you like, because while I know the guy definitely works for Google, verification of this information is basically impossible. But I believe him. Now, he's not working at management level, so he's not, you know, sitting in on management meetings and listening to this stuff. And I did ask him that. How do you know? And he said, well, this sort of stuff trickles down, Richie. He said they've made the decision. And what you're seeing in the newspapers and listening to on talk radio about how dangerous anti-vaxxers are and how much of a threat they represent to everybody's safety, this is all a build-up to this culling of tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of YouTube channels and accounts. It's happening, Richie. He also said that the claims that much of the 5G information, which they call misinformation, much of the vaccine information, which they call misinformation, the claims that we hear or that we read about in our newspapers, the claims that Russia is behind this stuff, is obviously nonsense. It's obviously nonsense. that Russia is behind it. But basically, this is all part of them legislating for mass censorship, getting the public to accept that there's a big threat, you know, that your health and safety is at risk because a foreign agent is spreading this false information online, even though the vast majority of groups on Facebook, at least as far as I've seen, and I'm not on Facebook very often, but I do ask Raj, and Raj tells me he's in several of these groups. The vast majority of these groups are what you would call grassroots groups set up by ordinary people who are concerned. They're not Russia. But it's those groups they want to get rid of on the pretext that it's Russia spreading the misinformation. So if you've got, you know, your own YouTube channel and you've put information on there, you really need to back it up. Anything that you've uploaded, videos that you might want to keep because you might have had an interview with somebody, you might have had a video with some interesting information, you've got to put these things somewhere safe. You've got to download them and put them, make hard copies of them, because this is coming down, according to my mate. And that's all I can say about that. Okay? I asked him about, you know, what do his mates think about it? And he said, there hasn't been much talk about it, maybe because people are very, very nervous working in tech, that if you were to be dismissed from a company labelled as a troublemaker, you might find it difficult then in the future to get a job in the industry with another company. So that's what he's saying to me. He says that he's hearing that the decision has been made in order to try and kind of see off opposition or resistance to a COVID vaccine. They've already decided in the weeks leading up to the vaccine becoming available, there's going to be a mass deletion of channels. People will be difficult to find using the Google search engine. And he reckons discussions have already taken place with Twitter and Facebook to work in tandem doing that. That's what he says, and that's what he said to me. You can take that with a pinch of salt, or you can take it to heart. It's entirely up to you. This is Wednesday's Richie Allen Radio Show, live from Salford.
Okay, so that's the Richie Allen Show this week, Martin. Well, he's saying it's an insider leak, and it does kind of make sense, doesn't it? A lot of this stuff around the vaccine. I mean, the big take-home from that little bit of info from Richie, I mean, we can't verify it, and he's making absolutely clear this is just a conversation he's had with someone. It's not an on the record, it's an off the record conversation. He's keeping them anonymous. Is basically, if you want to understand how safe vaccines are, you need to do that now, because a lot of this material may have disappeared off the internet by the time a COVID-19 vaccine comes along. And of course, that vaccine isn't necessarily going to be anything like the cowpox vaccine. It's potentially going to be an RNA vaccine, so it's going to be completely genetically engineered, or it may even be one of these CRISPR vaccines which go in to snip your chromosomes. Not a normal vaccine at all. In fact, I don't even think they should be calling them vaccines. But anyway, what do you make of that leak, apparently, that Richie's got there?
Well, I mean, we know that people are trying to control the narrative, and it wouldn't surprise me if preparations have been made of the kind he's suggesting. I still very much doubt that they've got a vaccine.
Well, apparently there's about 50 in the pipeline.
Yeah, but
the
none of them seem to actually work.
So far?
Yeah.
Well, several have been now being trialled on humans.
Yeah, well, it may well be that they'll say they've got a vaccine, which isn't really a vaccine for COVID at all. It's just got another purpose. That's perfectly possible. And then you know, they can then use that on the I mean, they were talking about injecting people with computer chips so that they can, you know, basically be tracked. Now, all of this is possible, but I think the answer to this is, when it comes to it, does it happen? And it's all very well to speculate, and we'll have to see, won't we? I suspect we're going to be dealing not with the problems with vaccination, we're going to be dealing with warfare-based problems and economic collapse
too,
problems.
Yeah, but I mean, obviously, if you put something in your body that's going to disable you rather than help you, then that's a big decision to make. I mean, we've got this whole thing of informed consent, which is the idea of you have a relationship with a doctor, and that specific individual and you have got a relationship over many years, even potentially, and that informed consent is a decision that you make based on the advice of your doctor. Now, we're now moving towards a much more coercion, aren't we? Where, so, for example, a government may say, you've got to have this. Now, they've done this with animals in the past. So, for example, they've had, you know, voluntary and then mandatory treatments that have got to be given to farm animals. Now that seems to be moving to humans, where we may have to have something. Otherwise, say, for example, we don't get our civil liberties.
Well, we shall see what happens when we get there.
That's why I think that debate is such an important one that Richie's having with his friend in Google there, that we should be making sure that we've got as much information as we need now, because in a few months' time that may have vanished from the internet.
I think the way they're going to play it, if they've got a vaccine, is they may already have a vaccine, of course, and that maybe the top people have already been given it.
Well, do you remember that leak, or supposed leak, that the guy in the White House saying, oh, it's okay, we've all been vaccinated? Well, he may have been just joking. But
it was certainly the case before the anthrax attacks after 9/11, George W. Bush and lots of people at the top in the US were all given anti-anthrax vaccines. That's before the anthrax was deployed. Now, you know, if it is a biological warfare attack by the US deep state, they may already have a vaccine which they're going to give them to their own people, but you won't necessarily get it if you might get a different kind of vaccine if you're just an ordinary punter.
Well, I mean, it does seem interesting, doesn't it? It's a public health issue, massive public health issue. You're saying, well, this is really important, we've got to enforce this because of public health. But actually, that censorship, due to public health, supposedly, could actually be quite useful if it came to a war, couldn't it?
Yes, because basically we're all going to be watched 24 hours a day. It's a 1984 style situation. We're at war with Eurasia. We've always been at war with Eurasia. And the real danger here, in my mind, is that they probably won't. Some countries, as I say, in Nigeria, the Nigerian opposition were saying that the government of Babangida was pushing through compulsory COVID vaccination laws with Bill Gates funding it, giving them a $10 million bribe, and they haven't even got a vaccine. And they were saying, we haven't even got a vaccine yet, and you're already pushing this. Now, what may happen is they're going to push it on developing countries like Nigeria, say, you make this compulsory, otherwise the IMF are going to crash your economy, and so on and so forth.
Well, the signs are stacking up, Martin. I almost feel like that Jimi Hendrix song, All Along the Watchtower. You know, what we're seeing is cyber battles going on, economic battles going on. The only thing that seems to be not going on so far, well, also obviously space war going on, is the actual shooting war itself. It seems to be coming down the line.
The shooting war has been going on, as we mentioned Syria earlier. Tens of thousands of civilians.
Well, there was no shooting of the airliner. It was just flying a jet.
No, I'm talking about the whole war. The whole war has been dragging on for nearly a decade.
And what do you make of the suggestion that because the United States and the NATO countries have been blocked from taking over Syria, that they've now directed their ire using this virus vaccine thing on the domestic population?
I think it's not just... where I differ from what you might call the alt-right, as mentioned by Richie Allen there, is they see it all as a conspiracy by, a global conspiracy.
Globalist?
Globalist conspiracy. But as I've mentioned to you earlier, there is more than one dog in this fight. The Chinese Communist Party has got its own agenda.
But then you've
the
got
Russian state has got its own agenda.
Sure, Martin, but then you've got people like Henry Kissinger, who've got his feet in both camps. He's definitely got feet in the Chinese camp and in the US camp.
No, the thing about Kissinger is he's a super gangster, and he's basically, they decided at one stage they were going to negotiate with the Chinese in order to isolate the Russians, which they did. They also, of course, got the Saudis to lower the oil price in the 1980s to make the USSR bankrupt. Then, of course, they started to raise the oil price.
They're trying to do that again recently.
Yeah, well, they're trying to raise the oil price now to bankrupt the Chinese. But, of course, the oil price is very low. The Chinese are just about to do a massive oil deal with Iraq and with Iran, which will sort their
Well, that will get the Americans
annoyed. Well, exactly. That's what this is all about. And it's quite possible...
Nord Stream 2 is quite
important. Yeah, Nord Stream 2, they're trying to pressure the Germans not to... To build the pipeline. They're nearly finished, but any companies have anything to do with it, the Americans are banging the table. And of course, the British are going along with, yes, we don't want Nord Stream 2, but the Germans are going to turn around to the British and say, well, you don't try and tell us
don't
what to
we
do.
Want cheap gas?
Well, we could get some of it, yes, no doubt, but it could be sold on to us cheaper. But we just do as we're told, Tony. The Germans, in fact, are now reaching the point, as the Japanese are, where they realise that if they line up with the Americans, they're going to end up with a war in a war with China and Russia.
Well, if we are,
and that's not in their interest.
If we are,
we will just do as we're told.
If we are going to see this massive wave, as Richie is saying there, of internet censorship later this year, and potentially a war too, a lot of the chips that will be being cast at that point are Epstein chips, that is to say hard drives of all sorts of powerful and rich political and commercial figures, and all sorts, in fact maybe media people too and military people, who knows, that are on the Epstein hard drives of the films that were taken in his various houses, and including of course on his island and in his aircraft. And this, I find it fascinating that the mainstream press has really kind of skirted around all this. But Whitney Webb, as you pointed out many times, Martin, has done an absolutely brilliant job in really drilling into the origins of the Epstein Maxwell child sex trafficking ring. And there's this video which has come to my attention by various people sending it my way, thank you everybody, but it's called The Head of the Snake, about Les Wexner. Now Martin, he's the probably known to most people, or the way he's impacted some people's lives, I'm not sure if it's yours, is by the lingerie shop Victoria's Secret. He's the owner of that around the world, a massive franchise, globalist franchise. So what do you make of this guy, Les Wexner?
Well, I don't know that much about him, but it wouldn't surprise me that a lingerie manufacturer is involved in child sex trafficking. I mean, there's plenty of overlap there, isn't
anyway,
there?
Anyway, fascinating interview between Maria Farmer, we're going to hear now, and Whitney Webb, your very own favourite Epstein journalist, Martin, about the video itself is called The Head of the Snake. It's about Les Wexner and exposing some of the real, basically the money power behind the Epstein Maxwell trafficking ring.
Epstein said this to me one time, but one day he pulled me aside and he said, Maria, look up. You see all this? And I'm like, what? And he said, this room, all these decorators coming and going and all this stuff being, all this artwork and this beautiful furniture. You see it all? I said, yeah. And he said, I got it for a dollar. And this is the first time I heard the name Les Wexner. He said, Wexner gave it all to me. He'll do anything for me. When I called the FBI, I'm going to tell you what I told them. I said, I know this is strange, but I said, I have a report to make on someone that I've been working for that recently kidnapped me. And they said, who are you talking about? And I said, okay, well, his name is Jeffrey Epstein. And I said, and her name is Ghislaine Maxwell. And I said, but here's what's important. It also involves the Clinton family. It involves Bill Clinton for sure. It involves Donald Trump. And I said, but the most important one, and I said this, that he's the head of the snake, is Les Wexner. And they said, what do you think he is? And I said, he's Jewish mafia. And they said, what do you mean? And I said, what do you mean? What do I mean? Yeah, I said, what do you mean? What do I mean? I said, he's not Italian. He's Jewish and he's mafia. I said, I can't be any clearer with you. And they said, how do you know he's Jewish mafia? And then I went on to list everything that I'd seen that was just so creepy. So one of the things that made me think it was all the passports. I know for a fact Epstein had an Israeli passport because he showed me, okay?
Yeah.
But Epstein, and I'll tell you about the Wexner, like why I think he's mafia, but I just want to say too why I thought it was really sketchy that they had, like, how Ghislaine had all those passports. She had a passport, a French passport, an English passport, an Israeli passport, an American passport, and there was one other. And then it made me really mad that when the FBI raided the safe, I know what was in that safe. And it's not a regular safe. It's a whole room, just so you know. So when people say a safe, they think, oh, it's a safe. It's Wexner had one, too. It's a whole room you walk into. And in that safe, he had a lot of photographs of children. And I know for about pictures of my sisters are in there. Because one of the people from his freaking office had told me they were in his briefcase. And he kept his briefcase in that safe. He also kept everything in there because he told me he kept it for Wexner, everything. And when I asked why they recorded everything all the time, I said, is Wexner really paranoid? And he said, yeah, that's Epstein said, yeah, that's one way of saying it. He keeps everything. He records it all. He said, I record everything, and I keep it for Wexner in the safe. Mm-hmm. So the first house I go to has pinhole cameras. Jeffrey's showing me. He's really proud of them. Second house I go to has pinhole cameras. He says, Wexner gave me this house for a dollar. Wexner gave me this for a dollar. Then I go to the apartment. They had pinhole cameras in the Victoria's Secret dressing room. And just to fast forward, when I was in Wexner's house, there were pinhole cameras throughout that thing. And Jeffrey again is like, oh, look at all the pinhole cameras. And Gilan says, you need to be careful. We can see everything. When I would go to the restroom or take a shower or anything, Gilan would call me, and from the speaker, and this is in New York, sometimes in London, in different places, she would say, get out of the loo, get off the toilet. She would start screaming at me. And I was on the toilet. And I'm like, what's happening? So then later Jeffrey's like, oh yeah, everything's being fed to Abigail. They're watching everything. They literally watched my every move, Whitney. Who does that? My point is, who has cameras everywhere? Sharpshooters, Doberman, mafia. That's why I said mafia. I'm like, I don't know anyone who lives like this. There were little pinhole cameras in that first mansion that Annie met Jeffrey in. And in the second mansion that he gave Jeffrey for a dollar, they were in the building that his brother owned on 66th Street.
The apartment
there were pinhole
building?
Cameras. And all these buildings that Wexner... Yes.
Okay.
All the buildings that Wexner had owned. Well, oh, here's where they were in the building that Wexner owned. They were in the Victoria's Secret stalls. Even though I had this driver's license, and Jeffrey had given me his SUV to use while I was there, but I couldn't go outside because, Whitney, there were sharpshooters, and no one discusses this, actual freaking sharpshooters everywhere. And anyway, the weirdest part about being at Wexner's was it wasn't the basement, because they had a basement. It was, like, below that, and there was a sauna in that room, like a huge sauna, and then they had, like, a vault, and then they had a door to an underground tunnel. And the only way I knew it was an underground tunnel was because their maid told me. I said, what is this door? Because I used to keep everything down there. And she said, oh, that's the tunnel that leads to the main house. I'm like, well, that's weird. Why would they do that? And she said, oh, you don't know? And I said, no. And she said, there's a giant 10,000 square foot floor that raises up when someone goes through that tunnel. And then they can enter the room secretly in, and then no one ever sees them. The floor raises up. She said it's 10,000 square feet. I mean, here's the thing. I lived there for 3 months, and I never once saw him. I saw Abigail on her horses, you know, go out to get her horses. You know, I could just see her and go out, but I never once saw him. And that's why I called him, like, the Wizard of Oz, because he was controlling everything, but no one ever saw the guy. Okay, so Wexner set up, just so you know, nobody talks about this, but Whitney, before that first house, the house that Wexner gave to Jeffrey for a dollar, you know, it's like a, you know, the mansion that he raped all the children
in.
Before that house, there was another one. Yeah, Wexner gave him that one, and that thing was incredible. That's where Annie actually met him. I brought her over there. But that house, that mansion then was later given to Gilan recently. She sold it to give it to, or the townhouse, whatever. And that's how she settled with Virginia. She sold that. Oh, my God, that woman. And she also had an apartment she took me to. So then she shows me all this stuff on the mantle. She takes me to the mantle. I'd never been in this apartment. It's on the Upper East Side. It was like probably 3,000 square feet. Really nice apartment. Like, I didn't have any friends that lived that well, you know. But it wasn't, like, you know, showy like her other places. But she shows me on the mantle, and I'm like, oh, what's this? And she said, these are things my father took from the British Museum. And she's like, they're ancient relics. And I'm like, did she just say that? See, I could never repeat things to people because they think I was lying or something. And I'm like, what do you mean he took them? And she's like, he took them. He liked them. And she's like, this is an ancient Peruvian relic. You know, and she's showing me this stuff that was 22 karat gold that had been taken from graves, but out of the British Museum. I'm like, this is not good. And then she showed me all the royals. Like, she had about like 12 photo albums of growing up with the royals. Everyone thinks that they met at Oxford. No, they did not.
Yeah, I'm lying people. About that. Yeah.
She showed me pictures.
Yeah.
She also knew Fergie, like, a long, long time ago, because I saw pictures of her super young with Fergie before she was ever married to Prince Andrew. And, I mean, it was weird. It's like they somehow she knew a lot of these people. Now, she knew Prince Andrew when they were definitely, like, I mean, she looked to be maybe 20 in some of these pictures, or maybe younger than that even, with Prince Andrew. And so I can date some of it by telling you that some of the photographs where they're all super young, they were making fun. I'm not kidding you. The pictures of Diana when she was just dating the prince, and Diana's in the corner crying in some of these pictures. And Guylaine's like, look there, we made her cry. Isn't that funny? We hated Diana. That's what she said. And I was like, oh my God, that's horrible.
I just don't think I have as many supporters in that environment than I did.
You mean within the royal household?
They see me as a threat of some kind.
Guylaine answers to Wexner. I know that for a fact.
So you think she answers?
Well, Wexner is Israeli intelligence, 100%. And it was a sign that she would be under him. And I know that's where she got all of her funding to do this scam with Epstein. I know that.
So, Martin, so much in there. I mean, let's just go blow by blow, I suppose. The idea that Jeffrey Epstein was some sort of financial genius is blown out of the water here, because you've got him buying a house from Les Wexner for £1, a large New York apartment. So, I mean, of course, that's quite illegal to do that. If I own a house, I can sell it to you for £1 if I want. But this is clearly a way of, basically, it's like money laundering. In order to be the financial brains, the property brains behind a whole operation, and hardly any money changing hands, because you're just giving a load of stuff to Ghislaine Maxwell and Jeffrey Epstein.
Well, if you read Whitney Webb's stuff, obviously that's an interview. But if you read her stuff on Mint Press News...
Yeah, Maria Farmer she was chatting to.
Yeah, on Mint Press News, it's got more detail. I mean, basically, going back to the 1940s, the mafia in the US wasn't run by Italians by and large. It was run by Jews. So Meyer Lansky basically created Las Vegas. And he worked very closely with the FBI and the CIA. And they basically had a program of what they called dirtying up. In other words, you get people involved in stuff which they would be very embarrassed to for it to come out publicly, and you use it to blackmail people. And they've been doing this for years and years and years.
And a whole load of passports.
Yeah.
And the
linkages are directly with the mafia, and the mafia itself is embedded with the CIA and Mossad. And this goes back to the 1940s. It's not some recent phenomenon. And of course, Ghislaine.
What about MI6 as well?
Well, they fish in the same ponds. But, you know, this has been going on for a very long time. And basically, virtually anybody in a senior position, either in the political or business worlds, are blackmailed by these kind of networks.
So the idea is that you blackmail a whole load of people, doesn't matter if they're bright or not, probably good idea if they're not bright, like Keir Starmer, and then they will just do as they're told, or Boris Johnson, or anybody.
Yeah, I mean, they don't necessarily go for individual politicians, they go for everybody.
Well, surely the idea is that you get someone where they're young, and then once you've got dirt on them, then they will be fast-tracked into a position of power somewhere.
Yes, and also, of course, it's just an insurance policy. So if they ever step out of line, you can then say, hang on a minute, we've got all this stuff.
So if you see a politician on television that reminds you of a zombie or a puppet, it might be because that's exactly what they are.
Listen, the State of Israel is a very small country with only a few million inhabitants, and it's very paranoid about everybody trying to take it down.
But this isn't just about Israel, surely. It's about the faction, the kind of, shall we say, British Israel faction in the UK, and the Christian Zionist faction in the US too.
It's hard to know exactly where the power lies within these structures, but it's pretty clear where the general thrust is. The mafia in Russia is largely Semyon Mogilevich, who's the top mafioso, capo di tutti capi. He is Jewish, Jewish-Russian. He's got Israeli citizenship. There are some estimates that up to 40% of the Israeli economy is controlled by the Russian mafia. Now, the Russian mafia, what happens in the mafia is that everybody gets together. There's only one mafia in the end. And it's linked to intelligence services, it's linked to high finance, and it's geared around objectives of control.
And what about finance? Obviously, this is a big thing for the mafia because a lot of people have pointed the finger at the City of London there.
Well, the City of London is a major focus for all of this activity. In the 1980s, after the Big Bang, what went on in the City of London, the New York Stock Exchange was still relatively regulated. So all the really nasty stuff, the stuff that, you know, the kinky stuff that you couldn't do in Wall Street, you could do it in London, which led to massive increase in financial investments in Britain. Britain is the money laundering capital of the world. Meanwhile, you have lame brains like Boris Johnson claiming that we are the ones who are trying to bring clean politics to the and to the third world and prevent them from stealing and so on. But of course, all the money that the Saudi royal family steals, where do you think it ends up? It ends up in the City of London, just like all the money that the Russian mafia steals. That's where it ends up, in the City of London. And of course, there are alternative money laundering centres. Las Vegas is one of them. Delaware in the US is becoming another. Nevada. And these networks, the criminal economy is absolutely embedded within the mainstream financial economy, as the former police officer, what's his name?
Rowan Bosworth Davis
has said on this show, who used to be part of the Met fraud squad. And people have no real idea about this. They watch.
Yeah, he used to talk about the joy of kicking down the doors of blue blood bankers at 2 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah, but eventually, of course, what happened was he was shuffled out, and none of these people were prosecuted. Because he's basically just too much of a small... He's become a criminologist.
Well, I think some were, but then there was a big trial, the Blue Arrow trial in 1993, I think,
yeah,
which was where they got some of the real top bankers. And that was... they were given a suspended sentence, first of all, and then the Court of Appeal dropped the suspended sentence. So the message went out very clearly, don't bother with these top people again.
That's right, and that's when he resigned from the Met Fraud Squad and became a criminology professor. And of course, he's submitted papers to
evidence
to the British government.
Yeah, saying that basically that it was organised crime. It was analogous. That basically the City of London's activities fitted all of the main international definitions of organised crime.
It does, and they do, and they are.
So. Anyway, I thought I did talk about it at the beginning, the Magnitsky Act. Maybe we could just start, Martin, with a little introduction to this, because it is the legislation which enables an arbitrary targeting of specific individuals. This has a massive chilling effect. And I think this is one of the things that's not discussed anywhere in any of the mainstream press, is the idea that you may travel to Britain and then you may be named under the British Magnitsky Act or the US Magnitsky Act, and you're travelling to the United States. That can mean your visa is instantly rescinded, and that your assets are all confiscated. Any of your assets in that country are confiscated. A little bit like, it reminds me a little bit about what happened to Meng Wanzhou, you know, the Huawei chief financial officer. When she went to Canada, suddenly this completely unexpected thing happened to her, and she's imprisoned, and now apparently she's going to be extradited to the United States, although I'm not sure the Canadians will really dare to do that. It's an absolutely reckless thing to do. And it's caused all sorts of trouble, obviously, in Hong Kong as well. And the fallout from that, the knock-on effects have been horrendous for 7 million people who live in Hong Kong. Just that one act of the Canadians arresting and then saying they're going to pass her on. But anyway, the Magnitsky Act has this effect. The idea it really being to stop anybody wealthy and powerful in Russia from actually travelling anywhere into Western countries where this act is in effect.
Yeah, and if you look at the Magnitsky case, Bill Browder, who's the billionaire behind all of this, Magnitsky was basically defrauding the Russian tax office. And Browder, who one of his business partners paid a Russian journalist to produce a documentary about it. And this Russian journalist went off to produce a documentary about what had happened to Magnitsky, having been directed by the financer of the project that Magnitsky was innocent and that the Russians had set him up and so on. And then he concluded that Magnitsky wasn't innocent and that the Russians were right and that he was basically a fraudster. And of course, that documentary has been suppressed. But I think we could probably put a link up to on our show page. I'm sure it's out there. And on the back of this, which is essentially fraudulent, both the US and Britain have now had Magnitsky Acts, which allow them to just designate any foreign person, or even presumably a British person, as being a human rights abuser, etc., etc., and therefore their assets can be seized and they can be imprisoned and without any court of law.
That's right.
No process, nothing.
There is no process whatsoever. You just are named by the government and closed down, effectively. The British Magnitsky Act was passed in May 2018, just after the Skripal affair. So that's another thing that, if you're scratching your head wondering what that was all about, it was about making sure this act took place in Britain. So let's have a listen now to Alex Craner. I spoke to him earlier this week. He's the author of a book called The Grand Deception, The Truth About Bill Browder, The Magnitsky Act and Anti-Russia Sanctions. And that was published in 2018. And I think you'll find this is a long interview, but it includes a fascinating section about the Epsteins and some of the totally unreported facts to do with the court case that's going on between Epstein's banker and Deutsche Bank, I believe, the people who were financing Epstein. So they're trying to find out where the money was going, where it was going to and from, and suddenly people start dying who are supposed to be appearing in court, and the judges who are supposed to be presiding over cases get threatened, and there's an attempt to murder them. So this is a quite wide-ranging interview, really, looking at UK-US-Russia relations, but particularly explaining how this Magnitsky Act works with Alex Craner, I did earlier this week.
I'm Alex Craner. I'm a former hedge fund manager. I'm a market analyst and commodities trader based in Monaco, originally from Croatia. I have published two books and one article in a peer-reviewed journal, and one of the books has been banned, deleted from Amazon at the request of one Jonathan Weiner, from who was the advisor of John Kerry in the Obama administration, from the State Department. And the book was about Bill Browder and the Magnitsky Act, which has been widely described as the opening salvo of the new Cold War between the United States and Russia. So that's basically where I'm at and the things that I've been interesting myself with over the...
Okay, I think, we're hearing a lot at the moment in the UK about Magnitsky Act. Can we start, please, with, who was Magnitsky? What was his first name? Who was he? And who is this Bill Browder guy?
We're talking about Sergei Magnitsky. Sergei Magnitsky was the employee of the Moscow-based law firm called Firestone and Duncan, which was established by one Jamie Firestone. This company worked for Bill Browder's Hermitage Capital, which used to be the largest foreign-owned hedge fund in Russia. It was managed by Bill Browder. Bill Browder is a former American, now British subject, because he changed his citizenship. Very likely an MI6 asset. He was the man at the center of events that generated the narrative with which the Magnitsky Act had been lobbied through U.S. Congress in 2012. Again, I'll repeat, the Magnitsky Act is considered as the opening salvo of the new Cold War between the United States and Russia. This passed in 2012 during the Obama administration.
I mean, how can it be part of a Cold War? This is just about economics and about money.
Yes and no. Basically, the Magnitsky Act ostensibly is a piece of legislature that protects human rights and punishes the human rights abusers. But this is merely the facade. In reality, the act sanctions Russian individuals or firms who are seen to have been involved in human rights abuses. The nature of the legislation is problematic because it does not involve any due process. So basically what happens is that some unnamed and unknown individual, some bureaucrat from the United States Treasury Department, at their discretion, can put Tony Gosling on the Magnitsky list. From that point on, Tony Gosling's U.S. assets and any bank accounts in the United States will be frozen, and you will no longer be able to travel to the United States, and you will have no recourse, no possibility to confront your accusers, no possibility of knowing what you're being accused of, or to be able to clear your name again. So the question is why these bizarre punishments for people who are merely accused of abusing human rights. My own explanation is because I have looked into this in some detail, and I've pondered the problem a little bit. My explanation is that basically we have to go back to the 1990s. What happened in the 1990s is that Russia transitioned from a communist economy to capitalist economy. So you were right, we're coming back to money. But it has broader ramification than just some amount of money over some individual business deal or interest. Basically, what happened is that during this transition in Russia from communism to capitalism, the Western financial interests have been able to spirit away from Russia to offshore centers conservatively between $200 billion and $600 billion worth of Russia's wealth. These are conservative estimates. It could have been very much higher. And we're not talking about market cap in a bloated stock market. We're talking book value of assets, right? So this is extremely large amount.
Okay, so the context of this is, you know, you had the oligarchs going around in Russia in the 1990s under Yeltsin buying quite cheap a lot of the massive state assets. And, of course, you know, as a communist country, there were all sorts of major industries controlled by the government. And those were often foreign interests. So I suppose the idea really there is that they would buy these assets up and then keep those assets abroad rather than within Russia, because they felt, particularly in the 1990s, they may have been right that Russia wasn't a very safe place to keep their money.
Well, yeah, especially if you're stealing it, you know, because the, you know, various mechanisms were used to plunder Russia's wealth. But basically, one of the biggest chunks of this was to place the key jewels of Russian economy into the hands of a hand-picked, recruited group of oligarchs. They have been recruited well in advance and groomed for this role by Western financial interests. I think virtually all of them from the Komsomol, which was the youth organization of the Russian Communist Party. So these were all sons of communist functionaries of the Russian.
So, I mean, you say well beforehand. How far beforehand? Because that, I mean, this does that make you suspect that that there were a whole bunch of people ready and waiting to pounce, and that it was all understood that the Glasnost was going to happen and that the communism was going to fall.
Well, there have been, and I unfortunately can't give you the name now, but there have been. Trips and meetings and pre-arrangements between the Western financial interests and the Soviet authorities going back into the 70s at the very least. So the banking reforms started well ahead of the Glasnost. the banking reforms which enabled these oligarchs and other entrepreneurs to register private banks in Russia with as little as $100,000 in capital and in how do you call it in the founding capital, and virtually with no regulation whatsoever. So there was some banking regulation that was introduced, but it was really not being abided by very strictly, and essentially anybody who could walk in with $100,000 could create a bank in the Soviet Union already before the transition.
Okay, so how did this with the oligarchs buying up all this state assets, how does this relate to come round to Magnitsky? Because that all started around about
1960.
There was a collapse, for people that don't know or don't remember or weren't alive, it was the massive collapse around about 1990 in the Russian economy. And the 1990s were really the Yeltsin era. Most of them were the Yeltsin era. And Yeltsin was really allowing a free hand for the oligarchs to do what they wanted until the end of the 1990s, the arrival 2000 of Vladimir Putin. So how does what's happened with Magnitsky and the timing of that fit in with the plunder of Russia?
Okay, so that's exactly the right question. Basically, and this has been my hypothesis, but I've already come across several people that agree with me on this, and then certain other experiences that are related to this also corroborate this hypothesis. And my hypothesis basically is that once all this wealth, once the ownership over all these key assets disappeared from Russia to various offshore jurisdictions. What happened when Putin came to power is he wanted to reverse some of these transfers of wealth. And so his government started to investigate the transfers of wealth, all these transactions, and to trace the assets where they went, so that they may be able to recover them. Now, to do this, you know, you can investigate in Russia what happened in Russia, but then to be able to investigate the transaction as they went offshore, you need to go through the jurisdictions like London and New York and the Cayman Islands and Cyprus and so forth, and Switzerland. And so in order to investigate all this, you would eventually have to go to these foreign jurisdictions. You would have to file various lawsuits, freedom of information requests, and so forth. And this is a very, very important part of the process, because if you go through the legitimate judicial process, then what happens is that various participants in this and various witnesses to this are going to be interviewed and deposed, and official documents are going to be taken out, and basically the whole affair comes out black on white on record, and then you cannot reverse it anymore and you cannot hide it anymore. And so the further you allow these investigations to go on, the closer the process gets to the culprits of the great plunder of Russia in the 1990s. And so my view is that there is this rush to introduce Magnitsky legislature in all the key Western jurisdictions, exactly in order to frustrate this process, so that the Russian investigators cannot trace back the assets to their ultimate beneficiaries. So that, you know, like if somebody wants to conduct an investigation, they can immediately be placed on the Magnitsky list. At that point, they can no longer travel. The witnesses can no longer travel. And now, one of the people who have agreed with me when I discussed this with her was Natalia Veselnitskaya, who is a Moscow-based lawyer and who did have some run-ins with Bill Browder and the Russiagate affair. But then, over the last few years, we've already seen that, for example, when the International Criminal Court in The Hague wanted to investigate certain
US and Israeli persons for suspicion of war crimes, that Mike Pompeo said that they would rescind their visas, that they would deny them visas for the United States. So this is obviously seen as a handy mechanism to frustrate certain judicial processes from running their course and reaching their full conclusions.
So the Magnitsky Act was passed in 2012 in the United States. In correct. The UK, there was an equivalent act passed. And you do wonder if this is just because Britain is now part of the US empire. In May 2018, just after the Skripal affair. So Sergei Skripal and Yulia Skripal were apparently gassed with some nerve agent in Salisbury, although there were various different people say different things about that whole affair. As a former BBC reporter in Salisbury for a year myself, I'm extremely sceptical about the official version of events there, knowing that, for example, that the chief constable of Wiltshire Police, it was his first day in his new job because the previous guy, who'd been extremely good, had been removed, scapegoated, effectively. So the new guy didn't have any real experience policing Wiltshire when this event happened. It was his first day. Plus, there are lots of anomalies in that account, not least of which is this apparent perfume bottle and some apparent confusion between the whether this was a professional outfit, if these so-called Russian agents were having sex with prostitutes, smoking cannabis, and this sort of thing. And there's a great deal of contention about, you know, what really happened in Salisbury. And then the other thing is, of course, that Sergei Skripal was involved with Christopher Steele in creating this Russia dossier in order to try and make out that President Trump had been using Russian help in order to get elected. And his biggest crime, it seems, of Skripal to me, is that he was then considering and wrote a letter to Vladimir Putin saying that he wanted to actually now to return to Russia. He got fed up with Britain. He didn't trust the Brits anymore. And at which point suddenly this incident happens. And of course, he's not going back to Russia now. The British may have been very concerned that he was going to appear on Russian TV, etc., talking about how MI6 had been working with him and Christopher Steele to fabricate a whole dossier of evidence about Russia and Trump. But anyway, look, the point being here is that this was the reason used in Britain to impose this Magnitsky Act here. So what do you make of that, Britain sort of falling in straight into line then with the United States a few years later, 6 years later in May 2018?
Well, I think that the way certain key legislature is being passed in the Western jurisdiction is not clearly a transparent above board process. I think that when a certain act has to pass, there are ways to pressure the lawmakers in every nation and to make.
I suppose that if the British are desperate at the moment for a trade deal with the United States, that might be a bit of leverage that would persuade the British to say, yes, we'll do this deal, this act, pass this Magnitsky Act.
Yes, but I suspect that there's worse than that, you know, like, because I suspect that there are control files on key decision makers in the whole hierarchy of the establishment. And that these control files can be used to lean on these decision makers to make the right decisions, to vote the right way, and to make laws passed that need to be passed. And so, you know, like, we've seen them, we've seen this kind of stuff again and again, you know, like, when the decision is to be made to go and run over Libya, there's hardly any debate about that. So, you know, there's clearly illegitimate aspects to the process, and the Magnitsky acts are very, very important to cover up the tracks of the great plunder of Russia in the 1990s. So by whatever means, by hook or by crook, there's ways to lean on the lawmakers to vote the right way and to make this legislature pass. There's also the process that sometimes you insert things into certain laws that most legislators want to see passed. Right, the pork barrel spending kind of laws, and you package it together with the Magnitsky sanctions, and then everybody said like, okay, well, let's pass this so we can get all these other goodies. So there are many different ways that certain laws can be obtained, not above board, not in a transparent way, but effectively they do become the law, and then the administration and the bureaucracy can act in accordance. And then a certain, you know, certain process that would need to be completed, i.e. these Russian investigations into the plunder of the 1990s, can no longer be completed, and they're completely frustrated at the root.
Well, the British Foreign Secretary, Dominic Raab, says if you're a kleptocrat or an organised criminal, you won't be able to launder your money in the City of London anymore.
Well, you know, that sounds like a solemn declaration, but I would take it with a giant grain of salt, you know, because when it comes to money, you know, this adherence to human rights and to morality is just it's just disingenuous and untrue. We've seen, for example, in 2012 also. For example, HSBC has been completely let off the hook with a small parking ticket after they have been caught laundering at least $7 billion for the Mexican drug cartels. That's, you know, how is laundering money for the Mexican drug cartels better than laundering money for Russian oligarchs? I mean, why is one category morally superior to the other?
The Magnitsky Act has also been mentioned this week in the Russian election interference report, which has come out from the Parliament's Intelligence and Security Committee. They've said that Britain has badly underestimated the threat to British elections from Russia.
Well, Russia has been generally blamed for every bad thing happening in the West, but you know, to me it makes very little sense. It's a constant thing. It's, you know, Russia has been blamed for undermining people's unity on the issue of vaccinations. They've been blamed for the downing of the Malaysia airliner over Ukraine. They've been blamed for the election of Donald Trump, for Brexit, for the Skripal poisoning, they've been blamed for sending agents to the Czech Republic to assassinate Czech politicians because they voted in favor of removing some Soviet era monument. And the list just goes on and on and on. Basically, anything bad that can sour public perception of Russia gets a great deal of media attention and practically like a public relations push. So I am very skeptical about it. I don't see Russia as this great global villain that does all these bad things while all the other countries are just like well-behaved children who never do anything wrong. So everything bad is obviously to be blamed on Russia. I think there are reasons why it is very important to the Western establishment to maintain a hostile stance towards Russia. There's more than one reason. I will give you the two main ones that I see. One is that we have a financial system that's like an inverted pyramid with a very, very small base and with a very, very large base and a very, very small, tip. Okay, and it's going to implode. The Western financial system requires a healthy collateral in order to grow, right? Russia is an enormously resource-rich country. They have 16% debt to GDP. So if Western financial interests could gain financial control over this resource wealth in Russia, that collateral would give a new lease of life to the Western financial system. So removing Putin, the Putin regime, which is pushing back, and putting in some other kind of regime like the Yeltsin regime that would enable Western financial interests to take control over Russia's wealth, is one important reason why there's the hostile stance towards the Putin regime. The other one is that one of the most powerful segments of our society is our military-industrial complex, not just in the United States, but in France, in the United Kingdom, in even in Germany. And for this military-industrial complex to continue bilking their societies and their population for more and more and more untold billions and trillions, we need to have an enemy. Why should we be buying all these fighter jets and all these rockets and ships and God knows what, and building all these military bases everywhere if we have no enemy? Like, if we can cooperate constructively with Russia, trade, travel back and forth, and develop, let's say, civilian business, butter versus guns, then we don't need so many weapons, right? We don't need to buy all these weapons and support all these military contractors, right? So it's extremely important to have an enemy. So the public image of Russia has to be maintained as some aggressive, nasty power that we have to constantly be on the lookout against, and that is always a threat to us. So we always have to prepare for a big fight and a big war. So that's two very, very important reasons why maintaining hostile stance towards Russia is very, very important to the Western financial and corporate establishment.
So what happened? How did Putin manage to get in 2000 if he was going to completely turn the tables on the international financial system? I mean, that sounds to me as if it was an incredible operation he managed there. How did he do it?
Okay, this is partly a mystery to me, and I have tried very hard to understand how he got in power. And it's a very, very interesting story. In many dimensions, it's very mysterious. He somehow ended up being friends with Henry Kissinger, among other people, because his boss in St. Petersburg, so he was an aide to St. Petersburg Mayor Anatoly Sobchak, right? And Anatoly Sobchak was apparently a Henry Kissinger loyalist. So Vladimir Putin became known and noted by Henry Kissinger and probably other powerful people in the West. Over the years, Vladimir Putin has done some work where he helped the Yeltsin family avoid legal liabilities for some corruption affairs that started to emerge late towards towards Boris Yeltsin's presidency. And so in this way, he gained the confidence of these powerful people and of the oligarchs. So the biggest oligarch at the time was Boris Berezovsky, who later ended up defecting to London. But Boris Berezovsky himself was very keen on bringing Vladimir Putin to become first the prime minister and then eventually to replace Boris Yeltsin. And having reviewed Boris Berezovsky's statements, he believed that he would be able to run the country by basically having Vladimir Putin there as a figurehead and then running the show in the background while Vladimir Putin passively enjoys his life of, you know, eating and fishing and golfing as a figurehead president. How Vladimir Putin and people around him managed to persuade these people that this would be possible, I don't know. But it seems to me that there was a network of clever people from the KGB who helped out, you know, who networked and made all this happen. And I think one of them is gone now. His name is going to escape me, but he died recently. He used to be the chief of the KGB. God forgive me. I just forget his name now, but he was, he founded one of the political parties with the Moscow mayor, Yuri Lushkov. So, the old.
Okay, well, that's fascinating. I mean, I know I was reading recently that Berezovsky and Putin in the early 1990s were off having skiing trips in Switzerland, and they were very, you know, personally very friendly. So, you know, what you say makes a lot of sense. How do you think this is going to all play out, though? Because this is the big question about the Magnitsky Act in the US and in Britain is if it does mean that you've got a complete cutoff with some of the most powerful and wealthiest people in Russia from the rest of the world, and they're not allowed to investigate or get back any of their assets. You've got 49 people, Dominic Raab now has said, are on the British Magnitsky list. These are specific individuals. As you say, they're just named, and then from that moment on, their assets are seized. They can't travel to Britain, etc. One does wonder what would happen if they were named as a Magnitsky Act person whilst they were abroad. Of course, just the fact that you might be put on that list would mean that you would very, very unlikely to want to travel to Britain. So it has an immense, which is completely unspoken about, immense chilling effect on relations between the nations. So, I mean, it does seem as if we're heading down the line here towards some much more serious conflict if they're prepared to take measures like this, Alex.
Yes. There's a great deal of moral hazard with this Magnitsky legislature. It is designed to protect a narrow group of vested interest in the Western financial circles, to the detriment of ordinary people and businessmen who might see much, much better interest in, let's say, cooperating and trading with Russia, in exporting their wares, on buying Russian products and sending them. So it's bad for the most people. It's only good for those who have participated in the pirate raid on Russia in the 1990s. How this plays out, I am not sure. It is very clear that the Russians are extremely persistent, that they are very scrupulous and careful not to discredit themselves by doing things like the Skripal affair. I do not believe for a second that they poisoned the Skripals in Salzburg. I believe that they are very careful to go through the legitimate judicial process, because whatever victories you score in that way cannot easily be reversed, whereas if you do something bad under below board, let's say, this only serves to harm your interest in the longer term. I think that they will be persisting in this. I think that from their side they will continue conducting investigations and putting pressures on other governments in various ways to participate with them, for example, with the government of Cyprus, with the government of Spain, and probably more in the intelligence collecting ways in places like Bermuda, Cayman Islands, British Virgin Islands, and so what, to continue to collect documentary evidence of what happened to their assets in the 1990s. At the same time, I think that Russia wants to in a real way counter the Western Empire. You say it's American Empire. I think it's not necessarily American Empire. I think it's more British Empire that has taken the United States as its military muscles since the end of World War I. But regardless, this is an empire that has its vested interests. I think they're headquartered in the city of London, and that the sub headquarters are on Wall Street. And I think that they are following strictly the logic of empire of having to eliminate every rival. And I think that at this time, their house of cards is starting to implode. So they're acting in more and more reckless ways. And I think that they're endangering themselves further because the time is running out for them. I think that one of the very interesting battles that are emerging there are related to Jeffrey Epstein, Ghislaine Maxwell affair, and now the court case against Deutsche Bank for laundering money for Jeffrey Epstein. We have seen already that Jeffrey Epstein's private banker has committed suicide. We have seen that somebody sent an assassin to the house of judge who was assigned this case against Deutsche Bank. And this to me, because, you know, assassination is very, very serious affairs. I remember years ago, I watched a lecture of a KGB defector in the United States from the 1980s. His name was Yuri Bezmenov. He was explaining that even KGB is extremely reluctant to do assassinations. And he explained that the reason is because when you decide to kill somebody, you have to kill actually three people. You have to kill your target, you have to kill the assassin, and then you have to kill the assassin. And all of this is necessary to completely cover your tracks. And now we have already seen that the assassin who was sent to this judge's house had already been assassinated. So they've already done two assassinations. Well, they haven't killed the judge, but they botched it and they killed her son and critically injured her husband. Her name now escapes me, but then the assassin, the suspected assassin, was found dead also, apparently of suicide with two gunshots to the head. And so the fact that the powers that be have resorted to these kinds of measures tells me that the crosshairs are very close to the target and that they're getting extremely nervous. I believe that in addition to, Russian government being a rival for power to this empire builders network, I think that the Trump administration is also opposed to this network, because it seems to me the Trump administration has been putting pressure on them with arresting Jeffrey Epstein, with arresting Ghislaine Maxwell, with starting these court cases against Deutsche Bank and so forth. So I think that they are in trouble. I think that the walls are closing in around them, and they're resorting to increasingly desperate measures. So I think it's been getting interesting, and I think it's going to continue to get even more interesting, but God only knows how it plays out, and I think it will be very difficult to predict what's going to happen. I only hope that we will be able to avoid the hot war between the Western powers and China, or Russia, or both, because I think that would be extremely, extremely destructive, and the world will never be the same.
Well, that's interesting. You mentioned Kissinger earlier, because he has some very strong connections both in China and in the United States.
Yes, of course, and in Russia as well. You know, there are always these networks of powerful people who are not necessarily, you know, like, you cannot treat any nation as a monolith. You know, you always have, you know, like, you always have, take Russia, you'll have part of the power network who are, let's call it, deplorable, patriotic Russians. And then you have the Euro-Atlanticists who are more loyal to London and New York, who will keep friendships with people like Henry Kissinger and George Soros and so forth, and who will be running the media for them and their open society foundations and so forth. You probably have the same situation in China, and you have probably the same situation in the United States, as well as Britain, perhaps. And so you always, well, I think that what we're seeing now is a bit of a civil war between these interests among themselves, possibly in China. And unfortunately, I don't know very much about the internal Chinese politics, but definitely in Russia and definitely in the United States. And I think that these internal conflicts will determine how these countries fall in line or not with respect to the empire.
But, I mean, you know, certainly the most interesting stuff you've been talking about is Epstein. You're also saying, though, aren't you, that you think that the City of London is still kind of at the centre, that they're telling the Americans what to do. I think there's a lot of people in the UK that feel that the Americans are telling us what to do, but maybe it's just the city telling the Americans, who then tell the rest of Britain what to do. But the other question, of course, is that there's a very close link, quite clearly, between the Maxwell family and Epstein and the Israelis. So where do the Israelis fit in? Because they're, you know, we're looking at, you know, basically organized crime networks that are centered around those three countries.
Well, I think that for all practical purposes, you can see all these, you can take Israel as part of the Western establishment, right? And I think that all the, in the Western establishment, all the intelligence agencies cooperate on certain things together, right? So German intelligence, Israeli intelligence, Italian intelligence, British intelligence, Australia, New Zealand, Sweden, Spain, France, and the United States and Canada.
NATO.
They all form, intelligence networks that closely cooperate. I'll give you an example. When Croatia joined the NATO, one of the preconditions was that NATO, in certain important segments, NATO takes over control over Croatia's intelligence services. Right. So you know, if something need be done in Croatia or on Croatian assets or laws or whatever you have, then they will find a network of people who will be able to cooperate with them. And I think that the same is true for Mossad, for French intelligence services, and so forth. It's all in the same network. And something you mentioned a moment ago that I wanted to come back to, I forgot, forgive me, so we'll just move on.
Okay. So I just wanted to see what you whether you think that Maxwell, who's you know, certainly her father, was known to be very closely connected to the Israeli Secret Service. I mean, how does that fit in? Because there's a lot of discussion on the surface about this whole Ghislaine Maxwell, Jeffrey Epstein business, but it seems pretty obvious that there was a purpose. What they were doing was, effectively, it was a blackmail operation. They were bringing powerful people in, having them filmed on the aircraft, in the various houses, etc., and that they now have a great big hard drive full of films of powerful people with right. young kids, teenagers, etc. I just wonder what you think, where that hard drive is. Is it in a nutshell? I don't know whether it matters. Is it in London, Tel Aviv, or Washington?
Huh. That's a very good question. You know what? My hunch would be in Washington. That would be my hunch, but I could be wrong. But, you know, this whole thing, this whole affair with Maxwell and Epstein is going back to, you know, moments ago we were talking about these powerful networks being able to lean on decision makers to make the right decisions in order to pass these kinds of legislations like Magnitsky Act. By way of having control files, and I forgot, I didn't explain what I mean by control files, but basically, if you have evidence of somebody's wrongdoing, for example, engaging in illicit sex act, or receiving bribery or so forth, then you can influence them to do your bidding in the legislature, in courts, or wherever it need be. So this is what I meant by the control files, and very possibly the work of Robert Maxwell, of his daughter Ghislaine Maxwell, of Jeffrey Epstein, has been to generate these control files, right? And I think that the panic about this is exactly that the wrong people will gain control of these control files. And I suspect that to an extent this has already happened. And I think that if you see the things that have been happening in the FBI, you know, like Donald Trump has been able to take control over the FBI, where when he joined the administration, when he came to the White House, the FBI was completely under control of the Obama era loyalists, which are, I think, people who are loyal to the globalist empire rather than deplorable patriotic Americans. And I think that the other agencies that he has to wrestle control of are the national security agencies, the Treasury Department, the Judicial Department, and the Pentagon, and the CIA, of course. And I think that gaining these control files will accelerate the, let's call it, the deplorable segment of the U.S. administration to gain control of these key agents.
Yeah, one of the interesting things is, of course, on that hard drive will almost be a control file on Donald Trump, which might have, maybe excited him to make sure that was in his hands rather than some foreign powers. But look, I mean, I've worked, in mainstream press in the BBC in London, Alex. You've worked in doing hedge fund managing, Can you just give us, from your experience doing the, you know, quite high level financial operation, you know, for ordinary folks out there who've never really been part of this world, how the world really works in a nutshell?
Well, I think that the skeleton of the society today is its financial system, because everything depends on the financial system, right? We're going into slightly philosophical realm here, but we are all born into this world which is astonishingly abundant, right? There's great abundance everywhere around us. If you look at the, you know, like you look around yourself, you see the houses, the apartments, the cars, the airplanes, the yachts, the amount of food that we eat and that we waste and so forth is just phenomenal, right? 100 years ago, we were less than a billion. Today, we are allegedly more than 7 billion. Still, most people eat. So there's this great abundance that's nourishing us. The problem is that most of us have no access to this abundance, because the ticket to this abundance is the money, right? So you can't just have a roof over your head and food in your belly. You have to pay for it. And to pay for it, you need money. And somebody controls the money. And they say, no, you cannot have this unless you can pay for it with dollars or pounds or euros or what have you. You cannot just give somebody a hair in exchange for a meal, right? I mean, you can, but it's, strictly speaking, is discouraged, and in many ways it's illegal. So to get access to this abundance, you need money. So we are all dependent mm-hmm. on money, and we all need to do what we need to do to earn this money. And so these are the chains. These are the chains that are restricting our liberty, that are restricting our access to the livelihood, to the comforts of life, to the joys of life. And the system has ways of always putting pressure on us, making it always harder and harder to earn the money to make a living. And now we've come to the point where it's become so hard and the system is so over-leveraged with debt that something will break and something is breaking, and the people who are controlling this system, right? And this is the essentially a franchise based in the city of London. So other central banks are basically franchise of this central bank, which is the Bank of England. They want to clear the deck. They want to start over, but while preserving the power structure as it is and the control in their own hands. The way this has been done traditionally is through world wars. This time around, they're having a difficult time getting a war going, but they have proven themselves to be very, very persistent in this way as well. So, you know, they try to get a skirmish going on between India and Pakistan, between Russia and Ukraine, between Greece and Turkey, between the Venezuela and Colombia, between, you name it, you know, Saudi Arabia and Yemen, Saudi Arabia and Iran and so forth. So anywhere where they can throw a spark, they try. And I don't know, this time around it doesn't seem to be working, but we still have to be on the lookout. And I think that we still have to be very careful not to find ourselves in World War III, because once the war gets going, I promise you everything changes. You know, today we can have a nuanced discussion about the Russians and about the Chinese and about the Americans and the empire and so forth. Once the war gets going, the society polarizes very quickly. And then you're with us or you're against us. Political dissent is tantamount to treason. And everybody has to line up behind their government, whether they like it or not. So I think that the way to do this is to make sure that the truth is accessible to the people, that people can discuss in terms of truthful information rather than in terms of lies and propaganda. And hopefully the great majority of the population will not have the stomach for war, and we can avoid it.
Fascinating. Alex Cranier, thanks ever so much for joining us.
Tony, thank you very much for having me, and all the best to you and to your listeners.
So that's Alex Craner there, talking to me from Croatia earlier this week. Kind of unique guy, really, Martin, in that he's, although he's worked in these financial circles, he's almost like a kind of poacher turned, well, gamekeeper turned poacher. He's now very critical of a lot of high finance, and even though he's still actually working in it, and particularly of Bill Browder and this Magnitsky Act, which it turns out it's actually an extremely political move, and it's almost extrajudicial, the idea that some official somewhere can just write someone's name down on a piece of paper and all their assets are seized. It does sort of go, doesn't it sniff to you of a bit of extrajudicial process here?
Well, definitely. These things have always been going on, but it's intensifying because of the nature of the crisis. You know, a Marxist would say that it's because of the falling rate of profit and all the rest of it underlying things. But, you know, that's a pretty comprehensive view of what's going on.
One of the big revelations we've got there, I mean, he was fantastic that he covered this, basically a news story this week that we might otherwise have covered, but he covered it for us. And this is the appointment last Wednesday, the 15th of July, 2020, of the judge, Esther Salas, on the court case to do with the Deutsche Bank and Jeffrey Epstein's bank accounts. And that happened on the Sunday. On the Wednesday, a FedEx person turned up, very much like that film, The 3 Days of the Condor, if you've ever seen that, with Robert Redford. If you haven't, you should. Terrific film from the 1970s. A man from FedEx turns up at the door, and as the son opens the door, her son, the judge's son, opens the door with her husband, Mark Anderville, stood behind. The guy just opens fire with a hail of bullets and kills her son. I suppose it doesn't really matter whether it was the judge that's killed or the son. There's a very clear message, a very clear mafia message being sent to the judge that if you try and pursue this court case, you're going to die, or people around you are going to die. So you better back off right now.
And also the guy who carried out the assassination then assassinated himself, supposedly, with two bullets in the head.
Allegedly, okay. Allegedly. Now, I've looked into this guy. He's the guy they've saying caused the assassination. The only person who, of course, will know that is can identify him is Mark, Judge Esther Salas's husband. And there's, just looking at Roy Den Hollander, who's the guy who's accused of carrying out this assassination, dressed as a FedEx delivery driver in Rockland, New York, where Judge Esther Salas lives. He's actually a lawyer. He's an anti-feminist lawyer. He's got his own website, and he takes court cases, basically a sort of Fathers for Justice type lawyer. It doesn't really sound to me as if a wealthy lawyer would really need to be a hitman for the mafia.
Well, it may be that he didn't do it, but his name is on the charge sheet.
Well, one of the things Alex is talking about there is, well, if you're going to assassinate somebody, you've got to assassinate the assassin, and then you've got to assassinate the person who killed the assassin as well, in order to completely cover your tracks. So it might well be that the assassin has been killed, who knows, but also someone else has been killed in order to fit them up as the assassin. Someone that whoever it is, maybe the mafia, wanted out of the way in the first place.
Well, I think it's
a double whammy, I suppose.
I think it's pretty clear that there's more going on here than meets the eye. And as I say, Whitney Webb's research going back to the 1940s in the US, it's not new, this stuff. Relations between organised crime and intelligence services have been going on forever.
But particularly in this case, we're talking about Les Wexner and the Jewish mafia. I mean, should you call them the Jewish mafia, the Zionist mafia, the Israeli mafia? Who are these people?
Well, they are mafia, and they are, some of the top people are Jewish, but I don't think they're very necessarily practicing Jews. A lot of mafia groups tend to have an ethnic basis because it's a basis of solidarity. You know, there's an Albanian mafia, and of course, Albanian's a rather obscure language, and therefore it's quite easy to keep things secret if you talk about it in Albanian, because nobody can understand what you're on about. And, you know, it's the logic behind Cockney rhyming slang and all the rest of it. But when money's involved, you're bound to find that, you know, all sorts of different people will be involved.
It might also be that Deutsche Bank are very, very nervous about all this coming out, especially they're on a bit of a...
Well, Deutsche Bank is probably going to collapse, and it's probably the most over-leveraged bank in the world. And when it does, of course, it will pull down the financial system in an afternoon. It's pretty certain that's what's going to happen. I don't think whether you're a left-wing or a right-wing economist, nobody is supposed to just pump up the stock market like we've been doing for the last 10 years. It's bound to lead to a crash. There's nothing else that can happen.
The Great Reset is... you keep talking about the war, but the Great Reset seems to be running parallel with this, potentially. That is the idea of a complete change in the international financial architecture. I think we should have a bit of a better look at that next week. But finally, Martin, for this week... the Ukrainian Nazis in The Guardian, this article that was removed. I don't know if you've seen that
story.
I looked for the article. I did see the article originally, but then I looked the day after and The Guardian had taken it down. I mean, it's actually a pro-Ukrainian Nazi article that The Guardian had published there.
Yeah, and it was picked up by Craig Murray, the former British ambassador of Uzbekistan, who's very involved in the Assange case.
The headline was stamps celebrating Ukrainian resistance in pictures, but those stamps happen to have Nazi symbols on them.
Yeah, they're basically, the Guardian has become a mouthpiece for British intelligence services, and they want to encourage the idea that the poor old Ukrainians have been oppressed by the Russians and now they're fighting back. And this is a picture from it's a picture from the 1940s from the Ukrainian.
But of course,
Nazi,
what's happening
Nazi
here
puppet state.
Is the Guardian is publishing pro-Nazi propaganda, and Craig Murray is calling them out. But Craig Murray himself is facing jail, isn't he? The former ambassador to Uzbekistan.
Well, he's being charged with contempt of court because of his involvement in the Alex Salmond's sexual harassment case. And, of course, I've read about this yesterday, Craig Murray is going to testify in the Spanish case against the private company, the security company, which basically bugged Assange when he was inside the Ecuadorian embassy. And the people and the Spanish teams that are looking into this, they've got the guy who's responsible. It's a Spanish private security company who did it under contract from the CIA. And they said they're absolutely obsessed with Ukraine. You know, basically they wanted to know what Craig Murray was doing. And of course, Craig Murray was the person who flew to Washington to pick up the MP3 of all of the emails.
The
memory stick from the DNC computers, which showed that the,
So this is a story where we were told was the Russians hacking it. No, it wasn't. This was given to Craig Murray, who flew on a plane across the Atlantic with the data.
That's right. And then he flew back.
It was given voluntarily.
Yeah, it was probably given by Seth Rich, who was the head of IT at the DNC, who was probably a Bernie Sanders fan. And he was getting disgusted that it was all being rigged against him.
So much of what we're seeing.
And then, of course, he was assassinated. Yeah. By somebody.
Seth Rich was, yeah.
And but of course, it was supposedly a robbery, but they didn't even bother to take his phone or his wallet.
It seems almost every week, more and more and more of our news stories are fussing about something that doesn't matter, or else they are simply there as cover stories for what really happened. So, you know, we're getting to the stage where increasingly watching the news, I don't know about you, Martin, if you ever do, but I'm sitting there thinking, well, we know what really happened here, and this is just a lie in order to try and cover it up. That's what the news is these days.
Well, I think what you'll find is that not everybody's got the time or the inclination or the training to look into things in the level of detail that we do on this show, which has been running for several hours now. Most people have to work hard. They get up early in the morning. They think they might have cancer. Their children are going off the rails. They watch the news for half an hour a day and they get a fairly distorted picture.
One good bit of news, Martin. We had our first pub visit this week. Have you been to the pub yet?
No.
Well, you should. I think you should, because it's quite interesting. You're not allowed to stand at the bar, but you can most definitely chat to people in there. There's quite a few people in the pub I went to in Kent. And lovely chatting with everyone. And actually, you know what? Most of the people in the pub were saying, this is madness, isn't it? this is just silly, you know. The idea that you're not allowed to stand at the bar, the idea that you've got to keep a certain distance away from people, there seemed to be quite a rebellious attitude. But the publican was basically resigned to it, saying, well, the only way I can make any money is to go along with all these rules. And it was actually a lovely atmosphere. I met some fantastic... And it's one of the lovely things about going to the pub is you meet people completely randomly. And, you know, you can make a friend in half an hour, an hour, and never see the person again.
Yeah, well, I spoke to my friend in Cape Town this morning, and you wouldn't like it there because they've banned all alcohol sales and all cigarette sales. And they're in permanent lockdown.
Well, no, I wouldn't. No, I certainly wouldn't. And actually, that is designed to send people crazy, isn't it?
Well,
if you can't have any alcohol...
The justification has been that the... Don't forget that South Africa is an incredibly violent place, and of an average...
Well, it's likely to be more violent now if people can't get their alcohol.
The level of shootings and... accidents caused by alcohol in cars has gone down dramatically, but the downside of it is that the very powerful gangs who run the townships in South Africa have now taken over completely the supplying of alcohol and tobacco.
Yeah, well, that's actually exactly what happens when you prohibit this stuff, is it's fantastic for organised crime, which takes us right back to the Epstein story and the Jewish mafia. Well, time to sign off now. Thanks to our guest, Irish Republican, Labour activist Martin Summers. You can download our MP3s and listen in the car or anywhere you like. You'll find this show's podcast, story links, comment page and our contact details at thisweek.org.uk. But you might not find it through Google. You might probably find another search engine instead. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Have a relaxing and enjoyable BCFM weekend. Sunday evenings at 6 with Danny Lopsch is always a good listen. BCFM boss Pat Hart did our say. Our sister show Dialect will be back on BCFM Mondays at 10, but so far it hasn't appeared. This show may be back in November, but don't hold your breath. Dear listeners, do please join us though for the Politics Show live stream at the old time of 5 o'clock next Friday here on this very channel, PRSC Radio. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.